You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
If the President of the United States said that, he's got his reasons to say it. He's got some convincing evidence that that took place.
Is President Donald Trump's tinfoil hat too tight? How did we get to a place where America's head of state thinks the American state is plotting against him? My guests Isabel Hilton and Jeffrey Howard will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including, is it too late for France's Republicans to rebrand their presidential candidate? And how do you persuade voters to look afresh at a political party? What will China's new civil law mean for Chinese civil liberties? And can female figurines on traffic lights do some small part towards undoing centuries of patriarchal bias? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Jeffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College London. Welcome both. Now, at the very real risk of tempting fate, and with due acknowledgement that it's only just lunchtime in Washington, today has been a relatively quiet one for President Donald Trump, the highlight of which so far has been blaming the wrong one of his predecessors for releasing Guantanamo Bay inmates who turned out to have been unreformed by their experience of American captivity. We return, therefore, to Trump's increasingly incandescent suggestions that he is being thwarted and beset by a so-called deep state, as if such an entity mightn't have taken action before now to stop the presidency being won by a woefully unqualified game show host. Isabel, first of all, this is my own pet theory, which I'm shamelessly projecting into the discussion. Is Trump's ascent to the presidency of the United States actual, final, irrefutable confirmation that no deep state exists, that there are no conspiracies, that there are no secret puppeteers? Because you would have thought if there were, they'd have fixed this before now.
Well, you might well think so. Of course, there's the other conspiracy theory, which is at least worth considering, that it is the result of a successful conspiracy by those who have it in for the United States. But, you know, that remains to be demonstrated. Look, is there a deep state? There is a deep state. It's the military-industrial complex. It's all of that. It's those bits of policy that never quite show their face, but influence government policy. But the idea that there's a deep state in the sense that, you know, it first emerged, you know, the Turkey or the Pakistan, in which the military absolutely manipulates a very weak democracy, the idea that that is true in the United States and that it is now conspiring against Trump, I think, you know, begs the question of surely Trump's difficulties in enacting policy are down to incompetence.
It's a thought, certainly.
Well, you know, it is at least in the other scale, I would say, it weighs almost as heavily.
Jeffrey, President Trump, to his minor credit, has not yet, as far as I can recall, explicitly himself used the phrase deep state. However, whether prompted or not, one Republican congressman, Steve King of Iowa, has referred explicitly to a deep state led by Barack Obama. Now, is there any way this is any less mad than it sounds?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we haven't heard the term deep state used by the president yet. We haven't heard it used by
As
Steve
I
Bannon.
Said, it's early.
It's early. It probably is only a matter of time. Look, potatoes, potatoes, you say deep state, I hear institutional resilience. I hear a stable civil service. I hear a ship of state that's large and resists change. I hear the steering wheel vibrating as you try to change it. Look, America is a very big country. It's a very complicated government. And if Trump is going to declare war on fundamental constitutional values, as many people think he has, it's only natural for there to be some pushback. But I don't think it's evidence that there's any kind of deep state at work. I think that it's a complicated government that has checks and balances, that has many different levers pushing, powers pushing against each other. And I just think it's ordinary democratic politics at work.
I mean, Isabel, is that a fair assessment? Do you think is what Donald Trump perceives as a conspiracy determined to thwart him actually just a government bureaucracy designed to stop a president doing as he pleases?
Absolutely. And I think that it isn't the deep state. It's the rather visible, overt state. And a lot of people who see their job as defending democracy and the Constitution, that's not a secret conspiracy. But it is, you know, if you have a group of far-right conspiracy theorists and people who conspire see conspiracies everywhere, so that people who have led clandestine lives tend to be paranoid and they tend to see conspiracies, they tend to project conspiracies onto everything. And I think that the origin of the paranoia in this White House, you know, comes from a very small group of people who've unexpectedly found themselves in power and can't let go of the reflexes, you know, that there is that everything conspires against them.
Jeffrey, to return to President Trump's apparent conviction that Barack Obama tapped his phones, and Barack Obama, to his considerable credit, has so far risen above what must be enormous temptation to reply, "Of course I tapped your phones. You haven't even found them all yet. I've put bugs in places you didn't know you had places." But his source for this, as far as it's possible to tell with Trump, it appears to be Breitbart or some other similarly conspirazoid website. Is there any fathoming why he is still relying on the internet and Fox News for his information when presumably he has a complete free run of the entire resources of the American intelligence services? He can spend all day reading the actual good stuff.
It's funny you use the word reading, because one thing we know about Donald Trump is that apparently he doesn't like reading. He likes his memos to be extremely brief. We know he doesn't read too many newspapers. The one exception seems to be the New York Times. We know he doesn't read lots of books. We know he spends most of his time in the evenings watching cable news. So it's not especially surprising that if Steve Bannon slips a Breitbart conspiracy theory into his morning portfolio, and it looks like the source was a far-right talk radio host named Mark Levin, cooked up the idea on air, and then it made its way into a Breitbart news story, it's not at all surprising that Trump believed it. A more cynical perspective, of course, is that Trump doesn't believe it at all, and what he's trying to do is muddle the conversation. The conversation up to now has been about how there's been these secret ties between Russia and the Trump campaign, and he's trying to put a competing narrative out there to distract us from that. Maybe because there is no there. Maybe because are no ties between the Trump campaign in Russia, at least no sinister ties, and so Trump is just infuriated that everyone's alleging that there are.
Yeah, Isabel, is there, just as a final thought on this story, in terms of the presentational aspect, is there likely to be an even bigger problem here for Trump? Because what we have seen in the last few days is his surrogates, of course, having to go out and defend this, you know, absolutely absurd nonsense. And they've done their best, bless them. It's a poor hand to have to play. But are they going to start to run out of ways to avoid saying, "No, I've got no idea what he's talking about either"?
Well, that's what they're paid to do. I don't have an awful lot of sympathy, but I do think that they may be trying to divert attention from the fact that probably there was some surveillance going on for organizations within Trump Tower, which included two Russian banks, which were quite plausible investigation targets for the Russian investigation. That's not the same as Obama ordering a tap on Trump's phone, but the idea that there could have been surveillance of organizations inside Trump Tower perfectly legitimately doesn't seem to me too implausible. And I think that all they've done is, by inviting us to examine all the possibilities, is to reinforce a story that they were trying to kill.
Okay, well, let's look now across the channel, where France increasingly appears to be regarding the most recent American presidential election as it once did America's revolution, as an aspirational model, though this was rather more explicable then than it is now. France's election has been every bit as undignified and depressing as America's, and may yet have as wretched a result. In a bid to forestall this, grandees close to Republican candidate François Fillon have been trying to find ways to rebrand their man and or their party. Jeffrey, first of all, he's got until April 23rd, I think I'm right in saying, is the first round of elections. So this is not a long game the Republicans can play at this point. Is there any hope of rescuing his image in the eyes of the voters at this stage?
I think it looks like a pretty uphill battle. And one reason it's a pretty uphill battle is that he doesn't fit into the frame of the moment. The frame of the moment isn't old-fashioned left versus right. It's this open, cosmopolitan, pro-globalization vision of politics. And the way that we think that, so Emmanuel Macron puts out a vision of a globalized France that helps assuage the grievances of his voters. Against this rival vision that Marine Le Pen puts forward of a closed nativist politics. That's the new schism in politics. And the pro-austerity agenda that's being sold by Fillon just doesn't fit naturally into that dichotomy. And so it's difficult to see how he's going to rebrand himself, because the two main positions that have been drawn in French politics are already being taken up by Macron and Le Pen, respectively.
You mentioned there Marine Le Pen, and Isabel, of course, she has on her own merits, whatever one may think of her politics, undertaken what you have to concede is a very successful rebrand of what was once an extremely toxic brand, which is the Front National, the party founded by her father. Her rebranding of the Front National went as far as actually expelling
her father,
then disowning her own dad, which is pretty rugged as these things go. But are there lessons there for how a party can be rebranded? I mean, I don't think anybody now believes that the Front National is necessarily a sort of, you know, beacon of progressive liberalism. But it is not. It seems to be something people seem less ashamed of voting for or furtive about voting for than they might have under a father's leadership.
I guess that's true, but I think we should also recognise that the public mood has shifted, you know, where it is now, I don't know if it's more acceptable to be anti-immigrant, but it does seem to be a mood, certainly it's grown in Britain. I mean, there are things that are said in British politics today that wouldn't have been said 5 years ago.
True enough.
And that's a function of politics moving to the right, politics moving to populism, this surge of grievance against globalization, and indeed everything that Fillon represents, the notion that traditional politics is corrupt, self-interested. All of that's been reinforced by this case. So, you know, she at least doesn't have that, except that she's being done for some misuse of European funds.
Oh, who isn't?
We'll see who isn't, exactly. Yeah.
Jeffrey, is that, though, basically the secret and or indeed the limit of rebranding a politician or a party, that you kind of have to just know what the public is in the mood for? If you think, I guess, if I think of a successful rebrand in this country in relatively recent memory, which was Tony Blair's rebranding of the Labour Party in the mid-1990s, did that only work because the mood for it was already there, or did that rebrand create the mood?
I think the mood was already there, and so I think it's about having the killer political instincts to read the mood and then the political skills to sell a vision that speaks to the grievances that voters have. And it's remains to be seen whether Fillon's going to be able to do that. I mean, ironically, the models for rebranding are right in front of him. Marine Le Pen shows that you can spend your whole career in politics and still be viewed as a challenger to the establishment. Macron shows that you can be the economy minister for one of the mainstream establishment parties and yet rebrand yourself as an upstart. So the models to emulate are right there in front of him. But April's coming very quickly.
I'm reminded of a conversation I had some years ago with a former aide to long-serving Alabama Governor George Wallace, who over the course of his career went from being an unreconstructed race baiter to somebody, I think he was carried over the line at the last election by an extraordinary majority of the Alabama black vote, having sort of rediscovered.
He became sort of national uncle.
Yeah, having rethought a few things late in life. But I did ask this aide whether this was a genuine epiphany or a sort of cynical political calculation, and received the wonderful reply, which sounded so much better, as everything does in an Alabama accent, that, as he put it, the governor was always really good at noticing which way the parade was heading and getting out in front of it. But that sort of ability to sense the mood aside, Isabel, how important are things like the cosmetics of it, the slogans and the logos, that kind of thing? Do they actually make a difference?
I'm sure they do make a difference, but only if they tap into that mood. I mean, the example of Tony Blair that you talk about, if you look what led up to that, you know, it was a very tedious set of industrial disputes, a sense that the unions were too powerful, a declining economy, a sense of economic mismanagement and general unelectability following an attempted coup by the far left. You know, all of that, you know, people were absolutely fed up with the old institutions of the Labour Party. So the idea that he could come along, represent some kind of social justice, but a modern image. He was young at the time, you remember. We were also fed up with a very tired Tory government. So he really was, he did seem to be something fresh and new, and the mood was there. You know, his slogans wouldn't have worked in the early 70s. They wouldn't have worked at other times. So getting out in front with the slogans and with the image, you know, the pink, not the red, the kind of the getting rid of all those very tired and by then seen as old-fashioned symbols was key. But they wouldn't have been accepted in the 50s or indeed in the 60s.
Might it be easier, therefore, Geoffrey, to do what Emmanuel Macron has done and just launch something completely new that you can brand from the start as you go along, if necessary?
Yeah, the worry is that you're going to come off to voters as disingenuous, as inauthentic. And if you aren't able to sell your rebranding as something you actually believe in, it's going to be a very, very difficult to get people to go along with you. I mean, a really good calculated rebrand will bring everyone along with you who supported you before and pick up new people. I mean, this is, I mean, not to talk about Trump too much than we need to, but this is what people were expecting once he won the nomination. He'd pivot to the center, he'd bring everyone who came with him in the Republican primaries, and he'd appeal to a bunch of independents. And if he had done that, he might have won the election in a proper landslide, winning the popular vote in addition to the electoral vote. But for some reason, he didn't, which was quite politically foolish on his part.
Well, I think his key mistake was to believe his own propaganda. And you should never do that in politics.
Amen.
It is strange, isn't it, though, that balance between whether a party's heritage can be an advantage or a burden.
Well, again, it depends on the wider mood. I mean, if a party, obviously a party, you know, there are people who will always vote Labour or Conservative, whatever it is, but there is also the wider electorate, and you don't win elections with that core loyal following. So you have to push it just as far as you can without alienating the loyal following, but broaden the base, which is, after all, the Mondeo Man argument, or the, you know, the kind of M25 argument in British politics. It was, what do you do about the swing voter?
Geoffrey, though, past a certain, I guess, amount of a party's history, do they have an institutional default that they snap back to? I mean, in this country in particular, we've seen various attempts in recent years to sort of get the Conservative Party away from being thought of as Theresa May once herself said, the nasty party. And yet it does still seem to snap back towards a kind of default of intolerant crankiness. And the Labour Party as well, sort of having been turned away from being a sort of unelectable, disorganised, faction-plagued, far-left political organisation by Tony Blair appears now to have reverted to what might be its type.
I think that's right, and I think that this kind of snapping back is a perfectly familiar feature of our politics. But I think this is changing. I do really think that we're approaching a moment where the old way of thinking about traditional left and traditional right is going to change, and we're reverting to a form of politics that really is about, are we going to be open and outward-looking and cosmopolitan and globalized, or are we going to be inward-looking and nativist? And you can be inward and nativist and pro-redistribution. And so I think we're going to have a lot of the old lines of division being confounded in the next 50 to 100 years.
Okay, well, let's take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Isabel Hilton and Geoffrey Howard. Coming up next, China.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo, once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. Doesn't matter how long I'm here, there's always something new. It's a very, it's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. There's more to discover all the time. And also there's so much that's new in Tokyo. Most months, actually most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on. So there's always something to keep us interested.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and Jeffrey Howard. And let's look now at China, where this week the Communist Party will unveil what state media are calling a declaration of rights for China's citizens. And given the Chinese Communist Party's record on rights for China's citizens, the fine print will be carefully scrutinized. Possibly ominously, the new civil law is also expected to codify social responsibilities, close quotes, for China's people. Isabel, how big a deal is this exactly? Do we know yet?
Well, this is all part of Xi Jinping's effort to present, you know, a mature and settled and socially harmonious country. He's talked an awful lot about rule of law, but he doesn't really mean rule of law. He means rule by law. It's the use of the law as an instrument of rule. And this is a long philosophical dispute in China between the Confucianists and the legalists. The Confucianists' core belief was that people were good and that they should be allowed to, you know, maximum liberty and guarantee of rights, and they would follow a virtuous leader. The legalist argument, which was, you know, begins back in the Qin dynasty, was that people are evil and they need the crack of firm government, and you need to terrify them basically into being good citizens. The legalist view is very much what's predominated in the communist period. So you have a body of law these days, which at least you didn't have under Mao. But that body of law does not submit, for instance, the Communist Party to the law. The Communist Party remains above the law. The citizen doesn't have intrinsic rights. The citizen has rights which are graciously granted to it by the party. So if you look at legal process, you know, if you happen to be accused of a crime in China, you're jolly lucky if you get a decent trial. You're very lucky if your lawyer doesn't get arrested. So there are grave limitations to the rights that are regarded as embedded in the citizen. They're just granted by the state and partially.
Jeffrey, since China opened up and started making what we think of as progress, and certainly since its people started making money, there has been an expectation slash concern that at some point those people would seek political liberties to sort of answer their economic liberties. Do we have outside China a clear idea of how great a hankering there is?
I think that certainly it's mixed, but, you know, I'm a old-fashioned moral universalist on this, right? So I think that human rights are good. I think that the rule of law is good. And so I think we have reason to welcome any incremental progress that can be made. But I share Isabel's caution about this. I mean, so, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of religion, these are still seriously compromised in China, right? They may be written down on paper, but they're certainly not protected. The Communist Party is not subjected to the rule of law. Property rights remain seriously fragile in China. And so while I think we need to welcome the kind of progress that's being made, the reforms here are quite odd, actually. If you look at the actual changes that have been made in this document, there are things like good Samaritans who injure strangers while trying to provide assistance will now be protected, right? They don't have to fear that they might be sued. So there are incremental changes that are to be welcomed, but these are not fundamental changes in Chinese law.
The good Samaritan one's quite interesting, though, isn't it, Isabel? Because it does appear to be a reaction to a couple of quite prominent, horrible news stories, but where footage went viral of people walking away from victims of accident or crime because they genuinely feared, and quite rightly, that they could end up in trouble themselves if they came to their assistance. Is this the Chinese Communist Party responding in some way to popular opinion?
Well, there is a popular anxiety in China, which is about the sort of core ethics and morality of Chinese society after nearly 50 years of communism, and the sense that the Cultural Revolution really destroyed the social fabric in a way that has not been repaired. So that after the end of the Mao era, there came the era of money, and that was just as bad, and that people have forgotten their common decency. So the particularly painful episode was a toddler, again, footage that went viral, a toddler who was hit by a car, lay in the road with people going by, and then was hit by another car. I mean, it was an absolutely dreadful, and there was a lot of self-examination of the variety of what's wrong with us. Why have we become these people? And, you know, Chinese society traditionally had a strong ethical core and a strong sense of morality. And there's a lot of anxiety about that. I'm not sure that the government's attempt to codify this is quite the answer, because there are difficulties with the kind of belief systems which could repair it. Falun Gong was popular in China because it very profoundly offered a sense of ethics and morality, and that got smashed by the party. But there's a limited tolerance for religion, partly in order to repair that social fabric and that sense of responsibility towards your fellow citizen.
Okay, well, let's go finally to Melbourne, where for a 12-month trial period, pedestrians negotiating the crossing of Flinders and Swanston Streets in the city centre will be instructed to walk or not walk by green and red figures, which are clearly female or arguably male and Scottish at a formal occasion. The idea is to do some small amount to reduce unconscious bias, that is, the assumption that the default setting of humanity is male. I will state my own case on this, which is that I am heartily in favour of this on the basis, if it does sort of at help to dismantle the oppressive patriarchal machinery of our society even some way, that's an added bonus. But what I can tell you right now, reading Australian media, it is annoying all the worst people in my homeland, and for that reason alone, more
go
power.
For it, yeah.
Absolutely go for it. But Isabel, in terms of its wider ambition here and wider hope, is this a gesture worth making?
Absolutely. I mean, what it challenges, and the reason that I think your compatriots are getting so cross, is this assumption that male is the norm, and that, you know, unless told otherwise, you know, everything is male. And I'm all for challenging that. I love the experiment in Vienna, in which you had all kinds of, you know, gay couples crossing, you had all, you know, every variety. Go for it, absolutely. And I would like to, you know, I would like to smash the pernicious influence of Thomas the Tank Engine, frankly, which I think has been has been one of the main obstacles to gender parity.
Jeffrey, speaking for myself here as one white guy to another, the thing that always blows my mind about the reaction to initiatives like this is the fact that there is always a coterie of, and it is usually white men, who get incredibly defensive, like genuinely really upset, as if this is, in what universe this is a thing to be upset about is beyond me.
Yeah, no, and I share your view that insofar as policies like this or changes like this upsets those people, I'm in favor of them too. Although I must say this particular one is slightly odd. So what's the unconscious bias supposed to be? Were women thinking that they weren't allowed to cross the street when it turned green, right?
No, I think it is just that thing that it's that sort of reinforcing the idea that that is the default setting. It's male. We have a humanoid figure there, so obviously they just chose a male one.
Yeah, although of course the fact that the image of the female bears a skirt raises its own questions about sexism and essentialism, right?
It does. And I haven't trawled through social media to look, but I'm absolutely sure there's somebody trying to outflank this maneuver by getting even more upset about something else entirely on that basis.
But I do think that there is this tendency of people who have been traditionally privileged in Western culture to feel like all the attention is going to people who are minorities or going to women. And I think this is, of course, entirely unjustified. But I think it's the sense that you have, you know, middle-class white men who have these grievances that aren't being attended to, and that's where this reaction is coming from.
I mean, Isabel, there are weirdnesses around this, and it may just be that it takes people gets a while to get used to the idea of new language or new words, I guess. But one of the examples that strikes me is that in women's cricket, they still seem to, even the female commentators and journalists, address the female batters as batsmen, just because it seems the idea that just
bat people.
Well, bat people sounds mad. Batswoman, it sounds odd. I mean, are there some examples in which the status quo, patriarchal and ossified though it may be, just does kind of work?
Well, we had this in the acting profession when the word actress seemed to have unfortunate connotations, and female stage persons preferred to be called actors. So yes, there are layers of a crude meaning, I think, in all of these. But I think that the rage and irritation that you feel, uh, that that you observe rather than you feel, is to do with the challenge. It's to do with the challenge of assumptions that makes people uncomfortable. I mean, if you have five people on a stage explaining something, I mean, at a conference, for instance, if there's one woman, it's sort of okay. But if there are four women, all the men start to get uncomfortable. Now, it's the norm for a woman looking at a stage that, you know, we're used to seeing rooms full of men, or, you know, men explaining things. I can't tell you how exciting it is when you walk into a room and it's just normal that there's a majority of women. You think, wow, gosh, that's what life's like for a man.
It seems only fitting that we let Isabel have the last word. Isabel and Geoffrey Howard, thank you both very much for joining us. That's the end of today's edition. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Stephen Kenny. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Midori House returns at the same time, 1800 London time tomorrow. For now, I'm Andrew Millett. Thanks for listening.